I think I was predestined to give sermons on Mother's Day. Because I don't know, some of you don't know the backstory of my life, but I met my wife Karen when I was 19. We were both 19 at UCLA. And she was a very sincere person. I knew that she wouldn't lie to me or anything like that, but there was one thing that she kept from me until after we got married. And that was the day she announced to me, she said, "Oh, by the way, Chris, I'm praying that God will give us girls." And I said, "Well, what's wrong with boys?" I said, "Well, because I don't know how to raise boys. I have one sister and a single mom. And we always had, you know, we were just three girls. And so I don't know how to raise boys. So I'm praying that God will give us girls." Like, what's wrong with boys? So she got pregnant about, 2 years later. And we thought of a name for a boy, Jonathan. And I thought, for sure it's going to be a boy. And out came Janelle. Okay. So Janelle was from Jonathan. I was okay with that. But and I started to learn what it's like to be a father of a girl. And then she was expecting our second, and I thought, well, maybe this time it'll be a boy, but no, it was Tiffany. And then I realized maybe her prayers are more powerful than mine, you know, like competition or something. But she was expecting our third, and I thought, just give it up, Chris. I mean, she was trying, she had her sonogram, she knew what gender was, and she didn't want me to know what it was, I guess because she didn't want me to go into mourning. So she bought all these yellow things for the room, and nothing pink, nothing blue, just yellow blankets, yellow balloons, whatever. And then came Emily, Michelle. And I finally gave up. But by the time she was expecting our fourth, I didn't even think of a boy's name because I knew it's going to be a girl, Bethany Grace. Four girls, a wife, and a female dog, and me, the sole representative of the male gender. What am I supposed to do now, you know? So I learned that soon after that my house would turn pink. Everything was pink. Hello Kitty. Strawberry shortcake and Barbie dolls. Everyone had at least two or three Barbie dolls. So that's a lot. That's 12 Barbie dolls. And then with the Barbie dolls comes the Barbie doll house, a big pink. It's all pink, you know, the Barbie doll boat and the Barbie doll this and that. I remember being at church at the church on Brady, and I would stand there in the parking lot after the service, and my girls wanted to go running around and playing. They'd say, "Daddy, can you hold my purse?" "Sure, I'll take your purse." "Daddy, take my purse." I had like two or three purses hanging there like a little Christmas tree with feminine things like that, you know. And I was destined to learn to live with women. And so now what is it now today, Wade? I have my mom, Lois, at age 95. I have my wife, Karen, my age, and I have my daughter, Tiffany. And I'm still head of a house of women. I have to keep reminding them. Sometimes they'll say, "Dad, we want to do this or that." And it's 5-1. And I'd say, "Look, I have veto power. Don't forget." And so we had lots of fun tension times. But I'm thankful for the fact that God gave me these little girls to raise. And I forgot when they were younger that one day they marry, and they marry a man. So I have three sons-in-law. And then my daughters decided they wanted to all have their babies together. So one of them got married, and she said, "I'm going to wait for my sister to get married, then we'll have our babies." So she waited 7 years, Emily, until Bethany got married. Then they both got pregnant. They both had boys. I thought, God has shown mercy to me. And then the next year, Janelle gets married, and they have three more boys. Each one of them had another boy. So I have five grandsons, three sons-in-law, and Marianne, finally, I feel like the scales have balanced out. In fact, I'm beginning to miss the girls again. So we prayed, you know, maybe one day we'd have a granddaughter, and she came. Last year, our little Bethy Grace gave birth to Gracie Beth. So Gracie Beth, as you can imagine, is the crown jewel of the Crossland clan. I'm thankful for the women in my life, and I'm thankful particularly for my mom, Lois. And on Mother's Day, I am very, very honored that I could bring this sermon to not just my mom and to my wife and to my daughters, but also to every woman at Gateway Church, especially those of you who are moms. Why the world needs more Christian mothers. There's a sad status of dysfunctional families today. According to the Children's Law Center of California, nearly 100 times a day, a child in California is placed in foster care. 100 times a day. Los Angeles County alone parents over 33,000 abused and neglected foster youth. Can you imagine that? 33,000 young kids who are abused or neglected. Too often, however, the dependent children in LA County lag behind the national standards in relation to the minimal care and protection we strive to achieve for foster youth. As a result, today's troubled foster youth may become tomorrow's troubled adults. More than half of these foster youth will be unemployed. Almost a third will become homeless. And 1 in 5 will be incarcerated within 2 years of leaving foster care. Of course, the role of foster parenting is key in helping these kids make it in life. They would be much, much worse if it weren't for our foster moms, right? Karen and Frank Schifani and my wife Karen, they both work in a foster family agency, and they are all about helping these kids develop a better life trajectory. But do you see why the world needs more Christian moms? Amen Clinics report 5 types of dysfunctional families. Number 1, the substance abuse family. Over 8 million children under the age of 18 live with a parent who has a substance use disorder, according to the social work and public health. When one or more parents abuse drugs or alcohol, it can lead to chaotic family life, as you can imagine. There are about 74 million children under 18 in the U.S. today, so that's about 11% of the kids today are in a home that has substance abuse. Number 2, we have the conflict-driven family. That's another dysfunctional family, the conflict-driven family. Is your family life filled with heated arguments, hurtful disputes, or long-running feuds? When family members are constantly picking fights or pressing each other's buttons to create conflict, it creates a highly stressful environment. Number 3, the violent family, another dysfunctional kind of family. Each year, approximately 4.5 to as many as 15 million children, or up to 26%, they're exposed to some form of physical violence in the home. And growing up in a volatile or violent family is a horrific experience that no one deserves. Family violence is not only physical, it also includes verbal, sexual, or psychological abuse, or any other behavior that makes you feel unsafe. Number 4, the authoritarian family. It's another problem. Authoritarian parents act like dictators, making great demands but giving little positive feedback. And mistakes are often met with severe punishment. Number 5, the emotionally detached family. In some families, signs of affection and warmth are missing. Emotional unavailability and a lack of hugs or hand-holding and other physical signs of love teach children to repress their emotions. This causes little ones to bottle up their feelings and have a hard time opening up to others, which can lead to a series of failed relationships. Hence, Marianne, as you shared, it's one of the most telling things was seeing how healthy your family life is, because otherwise it wouldn't bother you that much that you could not hug your kids. But to bring it to a point where you said, I'm going to take a bath, I'm going to do whatever I have to, I want those 15 minutes to hug my family, that shows that God gave you a natural, affirming love for those 2 children, for your husband, and that is a good sign of your family life. By the way, your car is beautiful. I saw you drive up in that car, Alan. I thought, whoa, I want to drive me somewhere for lunch. When this is all over, I want to go with you guys and try it out. The world today is in desperate need for mothers who are women of faith, women who love their child the way Jesus would love them. That's the essential part of a good Christian wife. It's not just someone who says, I'm a follower of Christ, but someone who actually imitates the very love of Jesus for that child in her love for the child. These women are not emotionally detached, but they affirm their love for their child daily. These women are not authoritarian or demanding, but they exercise their authority over that child with gentleness. These women are not violent. They're not screaming and arguing with other family members or their husbands. These women are not addicted to alcohol or drugs. They exercise self-control and sacrificial love. But you know what's interesting? As much as all of us would applaud these virtues that I just mentioned, and we would agree that a Christian household should be a functional household, not a dysfunctional family, the scriptures actually go beyond these basic qualities of a good mom or a good dad. The scriptures challenge us to develop and deepen our parenting role to include the very modeling of our Heavenly Father to that child, to those children. Why? Because it is only women of faith, of deep, sincere, real faith, who will fulfill their calling the way God intended. From the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis, we see what happens when a godly woman, okay? Now, I'm not talking about non-Christian women here. I'm talking about women who belong to Christ, women who are already have come to the point of faith and giving their lives to God. The book of Genesis, we see what happens when a godly woman has the basic human qualities of a good mother, and yet she lacks trust in God and takes matters in her own hand. And I want to give as examples here Sarah, the wife of Abraham, and Rebecca, the wife of Isaac. I mean, think about it. Sarah and Rebecca are in heaven with our patriarchs, right? Whenever Jesus talked about heaven, he said, in heaven, in where there's going to be Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, where all the patriarchs are there waiting for us to have our big party in heaven with God. And of course, their wives are mentioned there too. In fact, Peter says, if you become a woman of faith, if you trust God and you don't worry about the future, then you'll become a daughter of Sarah. Because Sarah also learned to have a quiet and trusting spirit, who called her husband Lord. And willingly submitted herself to Abraham. So there's already examples that we have. In fact, Rebecca, the first thing we find out about Rebecca, you might remember, is the servant of Abraham goes all the way to Haran to find a wife for his master Isaac. And he says, God, may it be that the woman whom I ask for water, she will not only give me water, but she'll say to me on her own, let me water all your camels as well, right? So instead of handing him a half gallon of water to drink as much as he wants, she would probably fill that thing 400, 500 gallons of water. It would take her hours to fill the troughs for the camels. But that's the kind of woman he was looking for, Rebecca. It says, Rebecca came there and she said, yes, Lord, drink. Oh, and let me drink. Let me offer water for your camels. And then he said, that's it. She is the woman for my master Isaac. So she was a very capable and very godly woman who did more than she was asked for. And yet we find out in both Sarah and Rebecca, they had their time of lacking trust in God. And what happened as a result of them falling back on this thing of, oh, I don't know if I can trust God with this one. Well, let's look at what happened when Sarah acted without faith. Now Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Abraham, behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go unto my servant, it may be that I shall obtain children through her. And Abraham listened to the voice of Sarai. That sounds very similar to what we see in chapter 3 of the same book. And Adam listened to his wife Eve. So after Abraham had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan, Sarai, Abraham's wife, took Hagar, the Egyptian, her servant, and gave her to Abraham, her husband, as a wife. And he went into Hagar, and she conceived. And when she saw, when Hagar saw that she had conceived, she looked with contempt on her mistress, Sarah. And Sarai said to Abraham, may the wrong done to me be on you. I gave my servant to your embrace, and when she saw that she had conceived, she looked on me with contempt. May the Lord judge between you and me. But Abraham said to Sarai, behold, your servant is in your power. You can do to her as you please. Then Sarai dealt harshly with her, and she fled from her. Hagar fled from Sarai. Wow, what happened? This is the first time we see a marital dispute between Abraham and Sarai, and that happened after Abraham did what Sarai suggested. She's saying, why don't you take my servant? So we as the reader, we find ourselves asking, Sarah, what were you thinking? What were you doing? And Sarah would probably tell something like, well, look, you can't, I've been waiting 10 years. Can you imagine 10 years I've waited? And my husband told me that God was going to give us children and so many children that we couldn't even count them for number. They would be like the sand of the sea or like the stars in the sky. And after 10 years, I mean, I figured I waited long enough. My body was getting to a point where I was starting menopause. And I just said, well, that's it. God must not want me to have a child. So here, go ahead and take this. This is the way we can solve this problem. And we say, Sarah, but you don't know the rest of the story. God has power. He could bring you a child even in old age. Well, that's because we know the end of the story, right? But Sarai couldn't conceive that God had so much power. He could solve it even in her plight of being barren. And so she resorted to that strategy, and Abraham gave in to it. And then you have this problem of Ishmael. And later on, Ishmael's mocking when Isaac's born. And there was such a division in that family, they had to put them away, separate them. What happened when Rebecca acted without faith? This is one of the saddest, most tragic stories in all of our events in all of Genesis. When the boys grew up, she had twins, Esau and Jacob. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man dwelling in tents. Isaac, the father, loved Esau because he ate of his game. But Rebecca loved Jacob. There's a problem right there, Alan, if you have favorites, right? The kids can pick up on it. Oh, daddy loves me more than you. Oh, Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebecca loved Jacob. When Isaac was old and his eyes were so dim that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, my son. Said I, here I am. So behold, I'm old. I don't know the day of my death. So take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me, and prepare for me delicious food such as I love, and bring it to me so that I may eat, and that my soul may bless you before I die. Now it turned out when you read the story that he didn't die for many years later, but he was blind and he was thinking it could happen any day. Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to her son Esau. So when Esau went out to the field to hunt for game, then Rebekah said to her son Jacob, the one whom she loved, right? Hey, I heard your father speak to your brother Esau. Bring me game and prepare for me delicious food that I might eat and bless you before the Lord, before I die. Now, listen to me, son, and obey my voice as I command you. You go to the field and bring me two good young goats that I may prepare from them delicious food for your father, just the way he loves it. And you shall bring it to your father and eat so that he may bless you instead of him before he dies. But Jacob said to Rebekah's mother, well, behold, my brother Esau's a hairy man and I'm a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me and I shall seem to be mocking him and bring a curse upon me and not a blessing. His mother said to him, well, let your curse be on me, my son. Only you obey my voice and go bring them to me. And you know the rest of the story. He caves into his mother. Just like Abraham caved into Sarai. Just like Adam caved into Eve. When a man has been told by God, wait, and I will bless you, or I will do this, or don't eat from this tree, and they listen to the woman's suggestion, like, hey, why not do it now because of this or that? Then he's got to pay for it too. And Jacob listened to his mother, said, okay, I'm going to do this. And she convinced him to go into this whole deceptive strategy to deceive his father, make him think that he's Esau, and then receive the blessing from Isaac, excuse me. So we as readers, we find ourselves asking, Rebekah, why did you do this? What were you thinking to deceive your own husband like that and to create this whole strategy where your son would come back and pretend like he was Esau and then get the blessing? I mean, didn't you know that that was not a godly thing to do? Well, she would probably answer by saying, well, look, when I was younger, I asked God, what about these two children in my womb? And he said to me, the older will serve the younger and the younger will become a greater nation. So I just wanted to, you know, when it seemed to me like Isaac, my husband, was not going to bless my younger son the way God promised it, I had to take things in my own hands. Wouldn't you do the same? What happened, Rebekah? Why did you not wait? Why did you not go to Isaac and talk to him, remind him of that promise? Why did you resort to deception? Look what happened, Rebekah. After you did that, then guess who had to leave? The very son whom you loved was gone, had to go back to Haran to escape from his brother who was going to kill him. And now you're without the very son that you loved for 20 years. You never saw him again. Rebekah, how could you? Rebekah was a woman of God. Sarah was a woman of God. Eve was made perfect in the beginning. But whenever a woman lacks trust in God, whenever she pulls back from trusting the very one who made her and the one who told her to do this or the one who promised her this or that, then she takes things into her own hands and she can cause tremendous sorrow for herself and her family. What about a positive example in the Old Testament? Here's a woman of faith who practiced faith from the beginning to the end. Her name is Hannah in 1 Samuel 1. We find a different kind of example of faith in 1 Samuel 1. Notice what happened to Hannah when she acted in faith. Now, Elkanah had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah, and the name of the other, Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. So this is what I'm surmising. This is just my thoughts here. But when I lived in Turkey, especially in the East among the Kurds, there were several young men that I met. They would say, oh, I have two mothers. I go, oh, you have two mothers. How's that? Well, you know, my father married twice. So one man, in fact, explained, he said, my father married his first wife, and then she didn't have any children, so then he married my mom, and that's where we came from. Another one said, oh, no, my dad had children with the first wife, and I'm from the second wife, but he prefers the second wife, or whatever. They always knew which wife he preferred, and she would always boast about it. Oh, I'm the number one wife, whatever. But I remember one man telling me, you know what, we don't get along with the other children. There's always animosity between us because there's such competition. But in this case, Elkanah had two wives, and it seems to me that what happened was he married Hannah, the wife of his dreams, the woman he really wanted to marry, because it says later on he loved Hannah, and she was barren. And after so many years of not having any children, it was not an uncommon thing then for the man to marry a second wife just so that they could have children. It's kind of like what happened with Abraham and Sarai. She says, go ahead and marry Hagar. At least we can have kids that way. So that was Peninnah. So Peninnah came along, and even though he really loves Hannah, Peninnah was the mother of all his children. He had, what, 5, 6, 7 children. Peninnah had all these kids, and when she had them, what did she do? She did the exact same thing that Hagar did to Sarai. She started making fun of her. What's the matter, Hannah? It seems like Yahweh has blessed me, and you're still there barren. And Hannah, well, let's read on. And this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And on the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion because he loved her, even though the Lord had closed her womb. And Hannah's rival, Peninnah, used to provoke her grievously just to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, Peninnah would provoke Hannah, and therefore Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said, Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? Come on, this is our festival. This is the time to eat this delicious food. Why is your heart so sad? Am I not more to you than 10 sons? Probably he was quoting her that one day she had told him, no, don't worry about it, Elkanah. You're better to me than if I had 10 sons. Even though Peninnah has the kids, I love you because you're my husband and you love me. And you're better to me than 10 sons. And so he reminds her of that. More valuable than 10 sons? Well, after they had eaten and drunk, Hannah rose. Eli the priest was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple. She was deeply distressed, and she prayed to the Lord, and she wept bitterly, and she vowed a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your servant, and if you'll remember me and not forget me, but will give to me, or give to your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. In other words, he'll be a Nazarite from birth. And she, as she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart, only her lips moved and her voice was not heard. So therefore, Eli took her to be a drunken woman. And Eli said to her, how long will you go on drunk? Put your wine away from you. But Hannah said, no, my Lord, I'm a woman troubled in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I've been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Please don't regard your servant as a worthless woman, for all along I've been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation. So Eli answered, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant your petition that you have made to him. And he didn't even know what the petition was. But he could tell with a woman that sincere who will cry out to God right here in the temple, I need to assure her that God will answer her prayers. And watch what happens. She said, let your servant find favor in your eyes. Then the woman went away and she ate the meal, and her face was no longer sad. Isn't it amazing how she had not received her child? She wasn't pregnant yet. Nothing of this had happened, but she was no longer sad. All the depression was gone. Peninnah, you can say all you want to say. I have a promise from God. They rose early in the morning. They worshiped before the Lord. Then they went back to their house at Ramah. And Elkanah later on knew his wife, Hannah, and the Lord remembered her. And in due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son. And she called his name Shamuel. God hears, right? I have asked from him from the Lord. So the woman remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, along with a 3-year-old bull and an ephah of flour and a skin of wine. And she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. And the child was young, but he was 3 or 4 years old. Then they slaughtered the bull and they brought the child to Eli. And she said, oh, my Lord Eli, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who was standing here in your presence several years ago praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed. And the Lord has granted me my petition that I made to him. Therefore, I have lent him to the Lord. As long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord. He belongs to you. And he worshiped the Lord there. So notice how many ways that Hannah showed her faith in God. She brought her need of barrenness to God in prayer, right? We read about Sarai. What does she do? I'm barren, I'm barren, I'm barren. Here, Hagar, Abraham, why don't you do it this way? She didn't go to God in prayer. But Hannah went right to the place where she could ask God, please And her prayer is a beautiful prayer of humility, saying, Lord, if you would be pleased with your servant, please let me have this. And then her request was accompanied by a promise to dedicate her son to God. There's another act of faith. I'm going to give him back to you, Lord. Her feelings of sorrow, they disappeared at the declaration of hope from Eli the priest. That shows a woman of faith, right? For her to instantly have all her emotions of depression gone. And then she gave birth and named her son Samuel, meaning God hears. So there's an act of faith again. Then she brings him back to Eli, as she promised, so that he could serve his entire life as a priest. And then her son was taught the scriptures from childhood on. By giving her son to Eli and letting Eli raise him, and of course it says that every year she would come back and bring him, and she would make him a little robe. So as he got older, he would always have a beautiful robe to wear. And Samuel was raised with the knowledge of the scriptures. And she made sure that that took place because he served as a priest for the rest of his life. Her son was taught the scriptures from childhood on. And finally, the last example of faith is in her hymn of praise. Listen to this hymn, or this prayer that God, that Hannah offered up after she brought her son Isaac to, I mean, her son, excuse me, Samuel, to Eli the priest. It says, Hannah prayed and said, my heart exalts in the Lord. My horn, that is my strength, my reputation, is exalted in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies, Peninnah, because I rejoice in your salvation, God. There is no one, none holy like the Lord. There is no one besides you. There is no rock like our God. And then she turns and looks at Peninnah and says, talk no more so very proudly. Let not arrogance come from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty are broken, but the feeble bind on strength. Those who were full, Peninnah, have hired themselves out for bread, but those who were hungry, Hannah, have ceased to hunger. The barren person has borne 7 children, but she who has many children is pining away. The Lord kills and he brings to life. He brings down to Sheol and he raises up. The Lord makes the poor, makes poor and he makes rich. He brings low and he exalts. He raises up the poor from the dust and he lifts the needy from the ash heap to make them sit with princes and inherit a seat of honor. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and on them he has set the world. This hymn of praise is an incredible declaration of God, his nature, his attributes, and his power over history, over world history. And it so impacted people that 1,000 years later, about 1,050 years later, there was a teenage girl listening to this story in a synagogue in Nazareth. And she identified with her and said, that woman is what I want to be like. If God ever gives me a son, I can give him back to the Lord forever. And he'll serve before him. She had no idea that one day Gabriel would come, the angel, and say, Maryam, you are going to have a son. And his name is Yeshua. He's going to save my people. And he became the high priest according to the order of Melchizedek, a far greater priest than Samuel. And she knew, she was so poor. Maryam was so poor that when Joseph took her and they went to Bethlehem, they could not afford a single lamb. So they had to offer 2 turtle doves in the temple for their firstborn son. So Mary, when she read the story, when she heard the story of Hannah, she completely identified. She no doubt had been put down by others in Nazareth too. Like, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with your dad? How come you can't afford a better wedding than this? Or what's, you know, why are you marrying this poor old carpenter, Joseph? And then on top of that, she had to suffer when people said, what are you doing pregnant? And there's no man around. Maybe there's some hanky-panky going on. No, I'm telling you, it was a miracle from God. Oh, sure. She had to deal with all that. Because when you read the benediction, when you read the Magnificat, this hymn of praise of Mary, she's quoting from Hannah's song right here. Several verses, several sentences come right out of that song from Hannah into her song of praise to the Lord for having been called to be the mother of Jesus. Because Mary and Hannah shared one virtue in common. They were women of faith. They had a deep, sincere faith in God and his promises. Right? Remember when Mary said, may it be done to you according, may you treat your maidservant according to your word. Behold, your maidservant, may it be done to me as according to your word. And so we find here women of faith in the New Testament. The contrast between women of faith and women who struggle with trusting God is also apparent in the New Testament. Listen to this description of 2 sisters whom Jesus loved. They're both godly women, right? They both entertained Jesus. They hosted Jesus in their own home. Luke tells us that now as they went on their way, Jesus entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. So that means Martha was the older sister, right? She was kind of in charge. And she had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. But Martha was distracted with much serving. And she went up to him and said, "Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her then to help me." But the Lord answered her, "Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things, but one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion, which will not be taken away from her." Wow. Maybe we would find ourselves asking the question, "Martha, what were you thinking? Why did you, don't you realize this was Jesus, the Son of God? And you're demanding him, you're telling him, you're complaining to him, saying, 'Hey, tell my sister to come help me,' when she's sitting at his feet trying to listen to his words? Don't you realize what's going on here?" She'd probably say, "Well, but you don't understand my thing. I was there. I'm trying to get everything ready, the food, and I'm trying to make everything look perfect because, you know, I have this guest in my home and all the disciples and everything. I can't just do it alone. I need my sister's help." But we'd say, "But Martha, it's not that your serving is wrong. It's that you were so distracted by it because you were overdoing it." You know, we don't blame a man for being a hard worker, right, Alan? A man should work every day, come home, be with the family. He provides for family. But what if you have what if you have a workaholic, what we call a workaholic dad, who's gone all day long, he comes home, has dinner, goes right back to his office in his home and works until 10 o'clock at night, and then on Saturdays he's gone, and then the kids say, "Hey, Dad, can we go to Disneyland sometime? Can we go to the beach?" "I'm sorry, son, I got a really important job, I gotta get it done." That's a workaholic. That's someone who's distracted with much serving. And there's a similar way a woman can go beyond the normal amount that it takes to entertain someone and get distracted with it, to get preoccupied with those things, and to forget and to miss out on the most important thing, which is, look, the guest that's in your living room is the Son of God. He's the very incorporation of wisdom right there. And if you listen to him, he's got a lot to tell you. Maybe spend a little bit less time on the food and just sit down with your sister and enjoy this moment. Luke's description is very telling. Martha was distracted with much serving. Mary sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. So I offer this question to those of you women in our congregation who are mothers or grandmothers today. When your children or your grandchildren think of you, would they tend to describe you as someone who spent morning, noon, and night serving the family, or as someone who often spent time in prayer and listening to the words of Jesus? Because, of course, when you listen to Christ, you will go out at those times, you'll find direction from him, and you'll be able to strengthen and wisely serve your family. You'll know when it's appropriate to say, "Okay, I'm done, and now I'm going to have time with God." And then you'll say, "Okay, now I'm done with that, I'm going to go back and serve my family." Because you have to serve your family. I know. I'm currently, Karen works 55 hours a week, and so guess who does all the shopping? Chris. Does all the cooking? Chris. Does the dishes? Chris. That's me. Me, me, and more of me. And I'm doing all the things that Karen used to do. I know exactly what it feels like to be a housewife right now. No laughter from that. If you need help in changing your focus in this regard, I encourage you to pray and ask the Lord for clarity on how to set aside time alone with him and his word. So I want to close with the example of Eunice. Eunice is the mother of Timothy. It says, "Paul came also to Derbe and to Lystra. A disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer, but his father was a Greek. He was well spoken of by the brothers at Lystra and Iconium, and Paul wanted Timothy to accompany him." Notice how much weight that Paul carried to have a man's reputation go before him. Timothy was well spoken of by people in both cities, and so Paul says, "That's the man I want to come with me." And later on in Philippians, he says, "I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon so that I too may be cheered with news of you, for I have no one else like him who will be genuinely concerned for your welfare. But they all seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But you know Timothy's proven worth, how as a son with a father, he has served me in the gospel." And in the letter to Timothy, he says, "I'm reminded, Timothy, of your sincere faith." Paul says, "A faith that dwelt first in your grandmother Lois and in your mother Eunice, and now, I am sure, dwells in you as well." So look at how many times the faith was propagated from mother to child. From mother to daughter, from daughter to the next child, even three generations. I think of my, let's see, who was it? My great grandmother, Katharina zur Brück. She came from the Alps in Switzerland, where they had a farm up there, and they made cheese just like any Swiss woman would do, and yogurt. And she came with three brothers and two sisters, and two brothers and two sisters. They migrated to Bethany, Oregon, and Helvetica, Oregon, and there they made a dairy farm. And there she met Robert Shaw, who was not a believer, but she married him, and then went to Seattle. She had one daughter, Louise, and four boys. None of the boys went to church, but Louise followed her in her faith because Katharina was a believer. I still have her Gesangbuch in German. It's all there, all the hymns that she would sing at church and her prayer book. And so she was a woman who knew the Lord and believed in him, but her husband was not a believer. And so sadly, all his sons never went to church. But Louise, the oldest daughter, she went to church. She was a believer, and she married Arthur Carlson, and he was a believer. And they together had Lois, and they had Bryce, and they had Avis, all three of which served the Lord all their lives. My uncle Bryce, in whose home I live in right now, is right next to us, just a block away. And my mother Lois was raised in the faith by Louise. And here I am, raised in the faith by my mom Lois. And I've raised four daughters in the faith: Janelle, Tiffany, Emily, Bethany. And they know the Lord. And guess what? Just a few months ago, I heard from Bethany, my youngest daughter, that my little grandson, Lincoln, said, "Mommy, I want Christ in my life." And he asked Christ to come into his life and forgive him. And he understood how Jesus died for him at little age 5. So how many generations is that? Katharina, Louise, Lois, Chris, Bethany, Lincoln. 6 generations of the faith, because they went through that maternal line. When you live out your faith before your child, even as a grandmother, when you live out your faith to your grandkids, it's going to have an impact on them that they cannot deny. You've all heard the name of Charles Spurgeon, the great famous preacher of the Metropolitan Temple, I guess it was called, Metropolitan Tabernacle in London in the 1800s. You know, Charles Spurgeon had, I think his parents were not really believers, but his grandparents were. You know what happened, Alan? When he was 18 months old, his parents either had some financial difficulties or whatever. We don't know what the problem was, but they asked the grandparents if they could raise him for a while. So they, at 18 months, they took Charles and they put him in with James Spurgeon and his wife. These were grandparents. And from 18 months all the way up to year 7 and a half or so, he was with this grandfather who was a preacher. And every day he got the scriptures just, you know, read to him as a little boy, right? From 1 and a half, 2, 3, 4, 5. He was hearing all these Bible stories. And when later on he struggled with his faith, he had struggles as a teenager. He was probably a prodigal for a while, but somewhere there around 16, 17, the Lord finally said, "That's it. You are mine." And by the time he was 18, he was preaching sermons that were just as powerful as his grandfather. It was his grandparents who brought the faith to that boy. And then, of course, through him to many thousands. Paul says, "But as for you, continue in what you have learned and firmly believed, knowing that from childhood you have been acquainted with the sacred writings, which are able to make you wise for salvation through faith in Christ Jesus." From childhood. So Eunice had the full backing of her mother, Lois, and together they were reading the Jewish scriptures, to the Hebrew scriptures, to their grandson, or her son, Timothy. And in fact, we see Eunice was described by the apostle as a woman of sincere faith. She had learned how to trust God from her own mother, Lois, and then she imparted that same childlike faith to her son, Timothy. His name actually reveals something about Eunice. It tells us what her prayer was for her son. His name comes from Time, which means to honor or to acknowledge the worth of, to give respect, to accord honor, and Theos, which is the term for God. Timotheos, or Timotheos, to honor God. And she wanted her son, since the time he was born, to be raised up as a godly man to honor her son. She had no idea that her son would be one day, maybe 20, 25, and literally take over the ministry of the Apostle Paul and change the history of Europe. So this name shows us that Eunice wanted to shape her son's identity as one who honors God by the way he lives. My mom did the same thing. Well, first of all, Theo, we see Wade and Helen have a son named Theo. That comes from Timothy. They wanted him to have that same calling of being one to honor God. And my mom, bless her heart, she thought about, it was her third child, and she thought, "What am I going to name this kid?" And she thought, "Christopher." Christopher means Christ bearer, but it also sounds cute. Chris crossing, you know, like railroad crossing. Or she didn't know I'd be teased. Chris cross applesauce all my life. But actually, I'm very, very happy with my name, Christo Ferro. Christo means the Messiah, Christ. Ferro in Greek means three things, to carry or to lead or to bear. And I finally realized that the older I got is that's what my life was destined for. My mom gave me the name Christopher. It means that I am to carry the love of Christ to the nations. I am to lead the body of Christ as a church, and I am to bear the cross of Christ. It helped me when I had my amputation to remember the meaning of my name. You are to bear the cross of Christ. Don't be ashamed of losing your leg. It's part of what I have for you. It's in your name. And don't sit back in America when you can go overseas and carry the love of Christ to an unreached people. That's why I have your name. And finally, when I came back and Steve Walker called me and said, would you help lead the body of Christ here at Gateway? I said, I guess so, because my name means to lead. The name you give your child can mean so much. Timothy lived up. He learned to live up to his name. And his mother, his grandmother, helped pave the way. After spending years as Paul's protege, Timothy became so reliable as a leader and so trustworthy as a teacher of the truth that Paul could send him to Corinth and to Ephesus, the two largest cities with churches in the hundreds or the thousands, and he could count on him to lead them with the same passion and skills that Paul had. That's why all these letters say, Paul and Timothy to the church in Corinth, Paul and Timothy to the church here and there in Ephesus. Timothy was his right-hand man. He was so reliable. He said, I have no one else like him. And it started as a little child in the lap of his mother, hearing the word of God, hearing it and hearing it and hearing it. That's why, Marianne, the fact that you loved, that tells me a lot, that you loved that role of being a homeschool teacher, right? There's someone I want to tell you about, Marianne, today before I close. It's the story of Susanna Wesley. You might have heard the name John Wesley, who started the Methodist Church, or his brother Charles Wesley, who wrote these beautiful hymns. Well, Susanna Wesley was the mother of these two boys, along with 17 other children, right? She had 19 kids, 8 of which lived to adulthood. Her husband was a pastor, but they actually had a stormy marriage, a difficult marriage, but she was a godly woman. And she raised Charles and she raised John Wesley, the founders of the Methodist Church. And later in life, John Wesley decided to write down some of the ways that she raised him, some of the things she did as a mother. Can you imagine having 19 kids? She had so many children, she didn't know what to do, right? So she gave them all broth without any bread and spanked them all soundly and sent them to bed. I'm sure she was tempted to do that. But no, John Wesley says this, in terms of religious education, the children of this family were taught as soon as they could speak, right? The Lord's Prayer, which they were made to say at rising and bedtime constantly. Susanna reminded her son. Worship and music. When the Wesley children were a little older, the day began with reading or singing a psalm, with reading an Old Testament chapter and saying private prayers, all before breakfast. Okay, are you done with your prayers? Breakfast will be ready after that. Come on. Didn't you read Genesis 17? Come on, read your chapter. Let's go. At the end of the school day, they paired up to read a psalm and a New Testament chapter every day. And the focus in the Wesley household, 9 to noon, the reason I'm saying this, Marianne, is because she was a homeschooler. She had 19 kids. Now, 9 of them died, or 10 of them died. So she had left, 11 of them died. So she was left with 8 in the end because she had several twins and the twins died. But anyway, in the Wesley household, from 9 to 12 noon and from 2 to 5, okay, so she was a homeschool teacher from 3 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the afternoon. And they were reserved for the children's education, which was a top priority for Susanna. She said, it is almost incredible what a child may be taught in a quarter of a year by a vigorous application. Because she taught them not only reading, which was very important, but she taught them Greek and she taught them Latin. For some of our mothers, you may be saying to yourself, well, it's too late now. I've already raised my kids. I don't have the opportunity to sit down with them and discuss the Bible in detail. And in fact, some of my children don't walk with the Lord right now. This may be the case. And God knows each one of us. He knows all of our weaknesses, all of our failures and disappointments. Even Susanna Wesley, like I said, she was not happily married. There was one time that Susanna and her husband, what was her husband's name? I can't remember his name. They had such a big argument that her husband left for a year and left her to raise the kids by herself and her maids. Oh my goodness. So there was a stormy thing there. And he was also a Christian man too, you know. But just remember that she wasn't perfect either. There was one time, okay, but God has amazing grace available to us for the rest of our days on earth. Even though Sarah regretted her actions and Rebecca regretted her deceptive plan, God still was faithful to use them and bless their families. And they, along with Martha, right in the New Testament, they died leaving a legacy of faithfulness to God. There's no question but that they belonged to the Lord Jesus, that they knew the Lord, that they had made a mistake, but they went on to serve him. And so that's what I want you to remember. God's grace is very abundant for all of us, no matter what we've done bad or wrong in the past. So I end with this prayer. May the Lord help our gateway women in their role as mothers and grandmothers. May he enable all of our women in this church to set aside time alone with God so that they will be known as women who sat at the feet of Jesus. May the Lord grant our women sincere faith so that they don't feel the need to be anxious or take matters into their own hands. May they learn to wait upon the Lord as he answers all their prayers. And may the Lord be pleased to lift up our women high in the eyes of their unbelieving relatives and friends to show them how different a Christian woman is from a non-believer, that they're the light of the world, the salt of the earth. For this is why the world needs more Christian mothers. Amen.